You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
They've crossed a line with my son Otto, and so it would be very difficult to look for a lesson here amongst this insanity.
Has North Korea pushed its luck too far this time? If so, why does Pyongyang's mistreatment of one American matter more than its mistreatment of millions of North Koreans? My guests Michael Goldfarb and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Colombia's sudden need to find gainful employment for thousands of recently redundant rebel fighters, a comeback bid by former Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and
new Aunt Jemima Deluxe Buttermilk Mix and this handy shaker. Here's a combination that'll turn out the best pancakes you've ever served.
When should a brand recognize that its time-served logo has been overtaken by social progress? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House, and we will start today with North Korea, one of the world's more reliable providers of bad news. This week's headlines have revolved around the wretched tale of Otto Warmbier, an American tourist who died days after being returned home from Pyongyang, where he had been serving a prison sentence for stealing a poster from a hotel. Mr. Warmbier's death is certainly a story and should certainly be covered, but not for the first time. The plight of millions of actual North Koreans is being somewhat overlooked. Michael, more than 3 years ago now, it is more than 3 years, the UN Commission on Human Rights prepared a report, a fairly thoroughgoing one based on interviews with exiles, etc., which likened the North Korean regime to the Nazis, which is not the sort of language the UN tosses around lightly. Why wasn't that a cue for more to be done 3 years ago?
Well, you may remember that the Nazis never got the atomic bomb. You may also remember that you know, the Nazis, the thing about North Korea, we talk about it because it may be the most irrationally governed state. Well, yeah, it's still the most irrationally governed state with nuclear weaponry in the world.
You were about to say something about the United Kingdom, weren't you?
Well, United States, actually. But I mean, here the irrationality is about just the political system that allows a government that's so weak to actually run the show. In North Korea, it is still essentially a vassal state of China. It shares a peninsula, a geographical location with South Korea, which in its time you could say was a vassal state of the West, but is now, you know, a fully industrialized nation. And so you can't just consider, on human rights grounds, going in and overthrowing a regime. Beyond that, I mean, and I think that this is really important. The one lesson that those of us who advocated, say, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and didn't weep when Muammar Gaddafi was dragged out of a drain pipe and beaten to death by people he had been abusing, you know, totalitarianism takes a whole society and infects its mentality. You can't simply remove a hideous regime and have 20 million or 40 million people suddenly go, ha, we can be democratic now. It never works that
way. The tricky question is always the and then what, even with the best will in the world. And I guess Iraq is it's probably the most recent comparable counterpoint. And Iraq under Saddam Hussein, which I visited once, was in no way as repressed and lashed down and as demented as North Korea. This is of another order. So one can imagine that the transition to anything else is going to be exponentially more traumatic. But do we get the sense that things are moving towards some sort of conclusive showdown? You mentioned there that the idea that North Korea is a vassal state of China, which is obviously true to a great extent, but I think it's also true that China can control its behavior rather less than China would like to. But yesterday we saw President Donald Trump tweeting that efforts to get China to bring North Korea to heel, as he put it, have not worked out. At least I know China tried.
Yeah, you know, this is the other wild card. North Korea is a wild card. Kim Jong-un is a wild card. And it's like playing Snap with two wild cards. Kim Jong-un is thrown down. They sent home Otto Warmbier. He was already, I think he was already in a coma, and he died within a few days of reaching his parents' house in Cincinnati, Ohio. On the one hand, is that casus belli? No. On the other hand, is Donald Trump capable of keeping his Twitter fingers in their holsters while, you know, serious diplomacy goes on, or just time passes? I'm not sure that in America this is a major, major event. I have to say, it happened. It was part of a news cycle. I don't think the ordinary American thinks it's time to have a throwdown with North Korea.
It is. You're right in that awful, though, what has happened to this kid is it would be startling if that was regarded as a casus belli. But what conceivably might get us towards that. There are reports that US satellites have detected activity at North Korea's nuclear test facility. If they do test again, which I think would be the sixth, if I've done the sums right, and this comes off the back of a spate of missile tests, are we nearing a point at which the rest of the world, whether that is China, the United States, et cetera, decides that awful though the cost of doing something is going to be, it has become less awful than doing nothing?
I think that that's possible. I think if you go back and you look at some of the reporting in November, when the transition between Obama and Trump was still sort of happening, you'll see that a lot of people, even though we're here in London and we have our own craziness to worry about in the Middle East and to be concerned with in terms of the outflow of refugees and terrorism, a lot of people feel that at a certain point that has to happen. And because it's not predictable what the outcome will be, it becomes necessary to at least contemplate some kind of, I don't know, joint action. I mean, if it was a different American president, you would absolutely think that it would have to be some kind of joint action and that there would be ongoing discussions with the Chinese about this, as well as, let's remember, you have to bring the South Korean government on side. They've had a change of government. They have a perhaps more liberal leader at the moment who is on record as being less interested in stoking up possible, war fever with his neighbors in the north on the other side of the DMZ. I don't know. And I think it's really hard to say. The big problem is, you know, the man in the White House is an impetuous, ill-informed, sadly, supreme decision maker. And if at some point he decides, well, this could be a place to make a mark, this could be he has advisors around when we're trying to, you know, create chaos, because in chaos, then the strong man can assert himself more. This is not a chaotic situation in America yet. Donald Trump is being tied down by the law over all manner of things related to his campaigns, close ties to Russian operatives. It would suit, I think, the Trump administration to have a major international crisis where he can assert himself absolutely as the strong man. And I think that's a terrible worry because, I mean, North Korea, in theory, is an easy one in the same way that Saddam was. I mean, I was in Iraq in 2003 for the overthrow. And, you know, at one level, it was as easy as people said. I mean, it was bad weather for 9 days, and then in 10 days, the United States Army was in Baghdad. And the only problem was they had no idea what to do once they pulled the statue down. I think, you know, similarly, we've built North Korea up, but, you know, this is one of those crises. It's slow on the boil. However, I don't think Otto Warmbier is enough to kick it off.
Okay, well, let's move along now to a somewhat more upbeat story in the shape of Colombia, which does at least offer some hope that decades-long states of war can be wound down and in due course wound up. However, having concluded a peace agreement with the indefatigable narco-Marxist guerrillas of FARC, Colombia now finds itself confronting one of the more awkward burdens of a new peace, which is finding gainful employment for people whose CV consists principally of kidnapping, armed robbery, and the maintenance of jungle compounds. Michael, you mentioned there Iraq, where something of a similar problem became apparent. Admittedly, it was an altogether self-inflicted one by the United States on dismissing the Iraqi military. But are there any lessons here from other perhaps other civil conflicts which have been wound down? Because it is a tricky one. There are people who have literally spent their entire lives. They've been raised in FARC, and now you have to find something else for them to do.
I think that Colombia, first of all, is a big enough country. Second of all, oddly enough, Irish Republicans have been making the trip to Colombia, for a long time throughout this peace process. Sinn Féin has been invited and did, in fact, provide some, ideas about how to move on from armed conflict to the FARC. I don't know. I think that the society at large has to accept the one truth of post-conflict in a civil war, and that is to have peace, you can't have justice. The general population.
You generally get a choice of one or the other, not both.
The people whose children were murdered by the FARC, whose fathers were dragged away in the night by the FARC, never to be seen again, have to accept that if Colombia is going to have sufficient stability to become the nation that it can be, then that means the FARC these ex-guerrillas are going to have a chance to integrate into the community, to open up shops, to be on the street. It's an extraordinarily difficult transition to make. It can happen. Often it happens within supranational bodies. I'll give you an example, which I think is not entirely relevant because it isn't a guerrilla war, but it's post-conflict. In Greece, in the 7 years of the colonel's junta, thousands of people were arrested and tortured. And I know some of them because that's how old I am. And I've had people describe sitting in a cafe in Athens and seeing a face walk into the cafe. And it was someone who was in the cell with them when they were being, who helped in their torture.
I mean,
and you have to accept that these things will be going on throughout Colombia. And yet Greece is held together in large part because it was brought into the European Union and was allowed, to proceed back towards some kind of democratic norm. I don't know if there's a similar situation in Latin America and South America to help, but certainly neighboring countries have to be able to help Colombia in this transition.
Because what often gets forgotten, I think, is that it's easier at some level to deal with the headline makers, as we saw in Northern Ireland, people like the leaders of loyalism and of republicanism could all be incorporated eventually into the political process, some of them in quite high office. And in Colombia, of course, we have the example of Gustavo Petro, ex of M19, who became mayor of Bogota and is now thinking of running for president. But people forget how difficult it is to accommodate the foot soldiers. And these are people who have become accustomed to gazing in the shaving mirror, or in the case, I guess, of many revolutionaries, not of a morning, and seeing. But nonetheless, seeing a kind of upstanding fighter for the freedom of their people. And when that condition passes, they're looking in the same mirror and seeing an unemployable hooligan.
I reckon so. I don't know exactly how this works. I know Colombia primarily through the works of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. and he says that people who are born to 100 years of solitude do not get a chance again on Earth. And I would like to think that was, at the end of 100 years of solitude. And I would like to think that at this moment, it is possible for Colombians to seize a chance. But let's face it, the seeds are in there forever war is almost part of the cultural history of Colombia. But let's be optimistic for this moment.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House. Coming up next, to Argentina, where Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner appears determined to keep going until someone writes a musical about her.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now to Argentina, where Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner never seemed likely to take to a quiet and unobtrusive retirement. It is therefore unsurprising that Argentina's former president has announced the formation of a new political party and her intent to run for a seat in the Senate later this year. Fernandez's new vehicle rejoices in the name of the Citizens Unity Party, with the avowed intention of combating what they describe as the, quote, reinstatement of the neoliberal model, unquote, by her successor in the Casa Rosada, Mauricio Macri. Fernando, first of all, what percentage of the Argentinian electorate do we imagine will be rejoicing at this news?
Well, of course, this is just a guess, but I would say a good 30%, you know, because...
That's a start.
It is a start. I think she's still kind of a very strong name in a sector of Argentina society. And of course, she got a lot of the votes, especially from the poorest in the country as well, even around the suburbs of Buenos Aires. So I think she's still a strong name. But of course, you know, there's quite a few, you know, corruption cases where her name was mentioned. Of course, nothing was proven. So I bet this made some damage. But she's still a very strong political figure in the country.
She was president for 8 years, of course, and that's plenty of time for people to make up their minds about you, indeed for kind of history and posterity to start to have some sort of impression of your legacy. What is her actual presidency remembered for?
Well, I think especially the last years, the Argentine economy was not doing very well. But let's remember that, you know, the first part of her presidency and from her husband as well, Argentina had immense growth, which they didn't have in the previous years. Remember where Argentina had a president, every year they had a different president. So, you know, I'm not sure. I don't think she would win another presidential election. But I think she's still a strong name.
See, on that subject, I am very far from being an Argentinian constitutional scholar, but I have done some research into this. Michael, I think it is technically possible she still could have a crack at it. She did attempt to alter the constitution so she could stand for a third consecutive term and failed. But as I understand it, once you've sat one term out in Argentina, you can come back and have another pop. Does that seem a plausible ambition for her?
30%? She only needs 6 more%. She'll be as popular as Donald Trump. From what I understand, it would be really, really difficult. Most of her solid support comes from her home state, which is in the south of the country. It's not that heavily populated, although it's rich in natural resources, which is, of course, what the Argentine economy is based on. They're like Australia, Steve. China wants what they've got, and they've got the money to pay for it. I think it would be difficult. One of the interesting things in doing some research, because I knew we were going to talk about this, is that a year ago, a little over a year ago, 14 months ago, the government had to settle with some vulture fund investors in New York on the default that happened during Kirchner's last term in office. And Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, had written about this is going to ruin Argentina, blah, blah, blah. And yet this week, actually, yes, it was this week, I think, they've announced, President Macri has said they're going to launch a 100-year bond on the bond market, and the subscription is going to be taken up internationally. People have started to think, well, actually, the long-term situation in Argentina, because the government seems to be less populist and chaotic as it was under President Kirchner, is worth a bet. And I think that if that gets started and she wants to come back, then there's a very strong argument that President Macri can make, say, look, we're rebuilding our reputation for stability and solidity internationally. We can recover the ground that we lost and the damage to our international reputation for having defaulted on bonds previously. And I think it'll actually be a lot tougher than she thinks. And I don't know. And Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice aren't writing musicals anymore. I don't know.
And let's talk about, you know, the way she announced that was in a football stadium, you know, in her very emotional ways as well. So it's a very grand return to politics in her own way.
Just a final thought on this one, Michael. As a general rule, not just in the Argentinian context, but in any context, should politicians, once they've had a certain stretch at the top, just really get off? I mean, I know she's not an old woman, et cetera, but this seems like a bad period to be standing up for the 22nd Amendment in the United States. But nonetheless, I do generally think that about 8 years will do, won't it?
Well, I think in any mature democracy, after 8 years, the voters have rumbled you and you should go. But we don't have a lot of maturity in the world. I'm not going to blame Twitter or Facebook because it's too easy, but we don't have a lot of maturity, even amongst people who are in their seventh decade. So I think you're right. And I think the big problem, of course, is it's a drug.
Oh, of course.
It?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
No, she goes to a football stadium. Donald Trump is constantly trying to find that hit from last year during the campaign when he had 12,000 people. Jeremy Corbyn, 12,000 people came out. He didn't knock on a single doorstep. Well, he did. But you know what I mean. And I think it is a drug. And I think that for her, clearly, it's a drug that she still needs.
Well, and that's actually could be a problem because, you know, I think it's going to divide even her own party. You know, the Peronist party is divided. So I think, again, only 30%. I'm not sure she'll have that 6%.
Well, finally tonight, we will look at the mixed blessing of a brand identity with a long heritage. On the one hand, it's an obvious advantage. Having been around a while confers the gravitas born of reliability. It can be tricky, however, when your particular brand identity was conceived at a time at which certain things were different. PepsiCo find themselves on the receiving end of a petition to change the name and brand image of Aunt Jemima pancake syrup by some who've taken offence at its deployment as avatar. An image of a smiling black woman. Some perspective here is probably in order. The change.org petition in question currently stands at 260 supporters, which possibly doesn't indicate a vast groundswell. But Fernando, first of all, is there a case against Aunt Jemima?
Well, I think historically, I've been reading a bit about the story. Perhaps there is, but I think the brand should look, and they should just, update. I think.
Their argument is that they have. It originated as a minstrel character, a straightforward minstrel caricature. But they do keep suggesting that since then they have updated it and tried to move with the times, etc. And I think, disconnected from its history, it now just looks like a picture of a smiling black woman. But nonetheless, there is the thing behind it.
Well, originally, I would say, perhaps there was not a problem. But looking at the history of the company and when it was found, where there was still slavery, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong. I think perhaps they should change just because of the US history and what happened.
Where is the threshold for this, Michael? There are various other brands and images around the world that have done this. Robertson's here in the UK, Robertson's Jam, called off its Gollywog mascot as recently as 2001, which is extraordinary. Crazy Horse Whiskey changed its name to Crazy Stallion after obvious objections were raised. I mean, the trouble is with things like this, there are no... It's hard to frame hard and fast rules.
It's very difficult, and what I've... Did you ever go to the cinema here and see a drink called Kia Ora that had really, I mean, it was...
That was available in Australia, I seem to recall, as well.
And it was, it was an orange drink, and there was this Jamaican guy, and it was racist, and they did finally pull it from the screens. The thing with Aunt Jemima as a brand, it's just the ongoing... post-civil rights debate. I mean, this petition was started by some very well-to-do African-Americans who are in the business and, say, well, we're going to take this away. And they say, well, what? And you recall all prints have gone with the wind and excise all the scenes with Butterfly McQueen. And
this similar argument has, of course, been had about the removal of Confederate statues in Louisiana, etc.
I've grown up with arguments about Step and Fetch It being, just an awful stereotype. And, 20 years later, young African-Americans who've got PhDs in cultural studies start defending Step and Fetch It and seeing in him a subversive form of performance. So it's a really dodgy thing, and that may explain why there's only 300 signatures. I am inclined to agree with Fernando, though. I mean... She was the original, the Aunt Jemima I grew up with was a really heavy black woman. She's now slimmer. But it may well be time to just leave the name and perhaps have some kind of logo design as a kind of compromise for Pepsi to make, Pepsi Company to make, about how to advertise this.
And, I'm a believer that don't think we should force them to do anything. I think the company, really, they should have a board meeting and say, listen, let's do the right thing. It's the same, I can imagine in my home country, Brazil, where in the 80s and 90s, even on TV, you had these blonde TV presenters dressed up as indigenous ladies and singing like, ooh, those traditional songs. And of course, this would be unacceptable today. But naturally, I think people just realize that this is not okay.
Exactly. And, very interestingly, the Supreme Court ruled this week. There's been a huge controversy for a couple of decades now about the team name for the Washington American football
team. Redskins.
So Redskins. Now, Redskin is regarded by Native Americans as being on a par with the N-word. Chiefs, they can deal with. Braves, well, okay. But Redskin is a straight-up racist term. And the team was taken to court. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that it was a First Amendment issue and corporations have the right to call themselves whatever they like. And so it remains in place. I mean, so Pepsi is under no pressure legally. It's simply a question of economically.
Well, by way of demonstrating just finally what an imprecise art this is, I can remember having this conversation about American sports teams years ago with a Native American activist, I think in Montana or South Dakota, and I asked him about whether he was troubled by the appropriation of the same iconography by the American military, Tomahawk missiles, Kiowa Chinook and Apache helicopters, for example, and he sort of sighed. He was a Cheyenne, if memory serves, and he sighed and said, well, I don't like it myself personally, but we can't win that one because the Apache think it's really cool. Michael Goldfarb and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Day Achakalan. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs, followed by The Cinema Show at 2000, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.